you need a PM and an engineering team that sort of goes, well, it's not completely impossible, so I guess we'll keep working on it.
It's kind of a race to find out how quickly can we identify if this is actually going to be a very successful, fully featured product.
It's easy to get distracted by smaller things that maybe won't end up with as much of a payoff in the end.
What's it like to manage a project where the unknowns are not just related to external factors, stakeholders, team performance, and resource availability, but rather to the scope itself, where the unknowns can range from, say, 10% to even 90% of the project scope? To design and manufacture a product or system whose requirements and capabilities veer into murky territory, or even totally unknown territory. It's kind of systematic bushwhacking, and it's a fascinating dance that PMs and engineers perform to successfully shepherd these projects from start to finish. In today's episode, we talk about some of the tenets, theories, and techniques for working through these amorphous and often ambitious projects.
From the Washington, D.C. chapter of the Project Management Institute, this is PM Point of View, the podcast that looks at project management from all the angles. Here's your host, Kendall Lott.
My guests for this podcast have vast experience working on projects that involve a certain degree of unknown. Randy Iliff works primarily in the outer realms of the unknown, where even the capabilities of the final product cannot be known. He introduced me in turn to Ruth Berry, who deals more with the mid-range, 50% unknown, projects. And Nathaniel Fisher hones closer to the mostly known range in product redesign. Randy Iliff is the founder and principal of Eclectic Intellect, a Madison-based company that provides a unique range of new product development support services to the innovation community. With a background in engineering, Randy's a founding member of INCOSI, the International Council on Systems Engineering, and has also served as chief systems engineer for the IceCube Neutrino Observatory, or simply IceCube, a neutrino telescope at the South Pole. You'll hear more about that in a few minutes. This interaction of the project management and the engineering, how do you define how the two fields normally operate such that there's a difference when they come together?
Within the entire spectrum of PMs that I've encountered, they range from individuals who are charged with recreating something that's already understood in detail, but dealing with the uncertainty that arises in the application circumstances, the management of resources, the measurement of time. And that may be in construction or production type things where done is already defined in advance. Your job is to deal with the variables of making sure it can happen correctly. Where my kind of world comes in is when that definition of done is fuzzy or missing completely at the beginning.
What's the PM's obligation in working in this engineering environment, or how do you see that work together?
Well, the trick here is that there are two different classes of work taking place at the same time. And one of those tasks is a straight execute per plan, minimize variance, do things as efficiently as possible, minimize and avoid risks. The hard part is the stuff that hasn't been defined yet, where the recipe shelf includes things like brainstorming instead of statistical process control, where it includes running a prototype of a system for a period of time just for the purpose of gaining more understanding about the intent and the options rather than it being an end item deliverable from the project. So it's the use of project time and energy to gain information that helps to define the project such that the remaining period of performance effort can be more focused on a specific deliverable.
Sounds like that's something that the original stakeholder, I perhaps would say the customer of the project itself, would be confronted with and understand going into it, right?
It's an interesting comment, Kendall, because in many cases I found that the stakeholder community greatly underestimates the amount of uncertainty that remains when they state a vision of I would like a new product that is comfortable, easy to use, and fun to play with, and they believe they're done with the specification and you should now go execute. Whereas in reality, all they've really done is define a target that has to be articulated and codified in sufficient way to be managed and executed. More often than not, I find that the stakeholders on the large developmental projects I've been around don't agree on what done should look like until the project is almost complete. There should be a convergence of those viewpoints all along to keep the project healthy and alive. But it's stunning to me how even in final test, people still have different ideas of what the system they're stakeholding should be part of.
You're taking me right to the heart of it to me then. The stakeholders in theory should have known. You identify they don't. So now we're at
who owns the obligation of identifying that?
Part of this goes to the nature by which large system procurements take place. They often make purchases of developmental systems and solutions or programs in the same way that they would buy capital infrastructure or commodities for their Xerox machines in the offices. And that method of purchasing forces all of the bidders to act as though all of the rules were known on day one so that they can get through the gate of award. And then you return right back to, hey, we just won it. Now, was it we were supposed to do? Let's get together and have a meeting and agree on that. But so there's an overlap here of the mechanics of procurement that works against the need to have this, I know this much, you must go do this, I will hold you accountable for it subset. And then another class of work which says, I intend to go here, you will be scored based on the ability you have to get me to these places and the quality of solution I have when I reach them. If you could take the politics out of it, then the PM would still be faced with the challenge of preparing estimates in cost, in schedule, in technical and programmatic risk for elements of the project that are essentially unknown at the time that they're originally being bid. And there's a sense that 10% of a project being unknown isn't that dangerous, and 50 would be pretty dangerous. And of course, if 90% of it's unknown, you know you're in a really major project. But what I've found is that even tiny amounts of new creep in and interact with other projects in ways that are surprisingly complicated for the PM to deal with. An example would be a derived requirement. When you get to a point and you decide you're going to use an evaporative cooler to remove heat from something, well, now you have to have a place to mount that. Now you have to have power for it. Now there's another inspection for that. Now there's perhaps a permit that goes with it. So it's each one of these things that then triggers three or four more things behind it that is very hard to articulate at the beginning. Even if the PM knows it and can make a good case for it from their experience, it's difficult to communicate that to stakeholders who perhaps have a different agenda.
So PMBOK says, figure out what your requirements are, develop scope, build a work breakdown structure. And then from that, a schedule, resource loading, dependencies, etc. We cannot do that because it is not yet known. And there are elements of things we will build that will actually introduce new changes. We know that those will be introduced, but we don't know what those impacts are. So one way this has been handled is Agile. How is this not a restatement of the problems that set us up for Agile?
The only part of this that's really different is this part that's changing. The part that's a constant can be treated with any type of method you want to use. That part's pretty easy. So step one is to split out as much of your understanding of the project from this part is known, it's relatively safe and stable, it's relatively independent of the decisions that are ahead of me, and I can begin doing pure PM, project management, on that type of work. The portions that are missing, then the program management aspect, is in what order will those pieces of missing information become available to me? How much of that do I have to open to see the connections to something else? And this is where we get into the brilliance of Agile, Kendall. What Agile does is ask you to break down that big ball of string into whatever degree of smaller pieces are necessary to get the information you need to make the next decision in sequence and judge the validity of that decision. At least in my experience, when I've seen Agile work very well, there's been a sense of the destination that provided a reference. There has been a logic of the way the time would be used, and then Agile has been used as the mechanism to get efficiency out of each increment of execution. The places I've seen it misused is when the top view was missing, and it was simply a minute-by-minute log of wherever the Brownian motion was taking the project.
When we know the goal, but maybe some of how we're getting there is undefined, that is where Agile may be very helpful.
Yeah.
But you're really calling out systems where we don't know what we're going to get yet.
Exactly.
So we're in the class of problems where the project output itself, done, as you said, is not known. I challenged that the stakeholders should have a sense of it. And you said stakeholders kind of know a result they want, but they don't know what done actually looks like.
And they'll all have boundaries in their mind.
Yep.
Yeah, so instead of saying, I need a model 17A with this option in it, and just press order on the keyboard, they say, I want something that does this. The very best communication I know to advise your listeners to seek at this stage is to ask people what they want in functional terms. I need this to transmit torque, not I need a drive shaft.
Okay, so we've got this first step where a PM says, great, I've been assigned this. I'm hearing this nascent engineer floating around behind this PM, though. What's the next step they need to take on this?
Well, obviously, you're looking to get some kind of a definition that is mutually compatible. If one of your stakeholders says it should be small, another one says it should large, one should be invisible, one should be bright, shiny color, you got to get those impossible to reconcile defects out of the way. And that gets you to the point where there's possibility. That'll be a big fuzzy boundary cloud, and you can now start looking at the inside of that cloud and say, are there any standard pieces of this that I can just go grab and use because they're fixed? I know I'm going to build them that way. A bridge, a railroad, whatever, just standard things that I can grab and go work on. Then you look at the pieces that need to be developed, and you're especially looking for the dependencies. So if you can understand task dependency for the flow of work, take that same skill set that every PM has mastered just to get a PERT diagram together or a network diagram, and now think in terms of not just building a building or a structure or a process, but building the definition of the work. So you may have a definition of, I'm going to replace a hospital respirator with a new unit. That's a fence that says I'm not building railroads or spacecraft or nuclear weapons, and it gets you started. It divides up the world. So this is all about reducing it to something finite so that it can, in fact, become a project or a program under deliberate control.
So you're still going to leave some fuzzy space in here, it sounds like.
Yeah, the first piece is the outside boundary. You want as good a stone fence around the outside as you get, even though you know you're going to go back and revisit as you get smarter. And then you want to start carving up the territory on the inside to find as much independence as possible. So all of the dependency tests that a PM is used to thinking about in terms of resources or other capabilities, dependencies, it's now just in the definition of the work. You want to expand to a point where you have enough understanding to think, you know, I'm pretty good at this. I need to start actually accomplishing some work. And then you switch from expansion into convergence. So if you say there are basically two types of work, the stuff that's new and the stuff you already know how to do, you just want to do over again. That divides the work up into two classes. For the stuff that's new, I want the fastest definition of that bubble so that it can be reduced to normal execution type work. There are two features that are kind of missing from program project management software today that may help this conversation. One of them is conditional branching. I've yet to see a project plan that gets to a point and says, if this, then I follow this line. If not, I follow the other one, and the rest of this is ignored. There's an assumption in almost every project plan that every task you see will always be executed, and yet in a developmental world, that simply doesn't happen. There's also recursion, which if you've run any kind of a programming language, you can call it a do loop in the old Fortran days or whatever, but you stay in that until you hit a condition and then you exit. So I would stay in engineering definition until my stakeholders all agreed on what I wanted to go build, and then I'd release it to manufacturing. That sounds great to the engineer, but it doesn't look really good to the PM who is wondering, when do I schedule that? I got a boss up here who wants me to have it delivered by September. Is that possible? Impossible?
So it's going to take a PM who's trained differently to even start seeing this. It seems, on the other hand, I realize 2 seconds into the project, they're going to start being in trouble if they haven't looked at it this way.
And this is why it's so important to say there's two things going on at the same time. Because if we don't do this, Kendall, then there'll be a danger for PMs to say, okay, I get this. I have to wait until I know what the requirements are before I start committing big resources. And that's a pretty good model, except it's not true for the whole project.
Right.
In even the most exotic things I've ever worked on, there's a subset of the project that can begin on day one using structured, legitimate, disciplined PMI methods, and that project will be better in those tasks for applying that discipline from the very beginning. Your goal is to take the stuff that can't go through that model yet because it lacks definition, give it that definition, and then move it over to the other side of the fence where it's safe as rapidly as possible.
There are projects that will end up with some fuzziness still for quite a while. In fact, there may be this level of recursion and condition. I'm thinking of conditional branching, where we simply now know that we cannot know until we engage, right? Where we begin to do a prototype, when we test something, when we build something. Yeah. So how does a project manager handle that? They're communicating it. They just plan and leave that as an open budget item.
Yeah, it sounds terrifying when you say, oh my God, I've got everything as a variable. But anyone who's ever been a parent knows there's a small number of things you must control, and then there's day-to-day stuff that just simply happens. And if you're raising a good, healthy child based on whatever the standards of the stakeholders are, that's probably a better analogy to developmental projects than the manufacturing, I do this, then I put in part B, then I put in part C model that some of the really mechanical project management guidance might have you believe.
So what do you suggest that they're doing there? They take that as an acceptable risk, or?
PMs who work in this developmental space have to have a respect for the additional level of complexity. They have to be able to communicate that to stakeholders to be able to shift the use of timing in the project a little bit. There needs to be more of the total project or program time spent at the beginning to understand what the destination is before you begin accelerating towards it. In design, the difference between a really good solution, an acceptable one, and a failing one can be billions of dollars to the corporation that has the brand on that product. So there's an investment component to development, whereas there is a cost management component to pure PM execution.
What happens when it's 10% new and 90% understood, 50-50 split, and then perhaps a complete flip where almost all of it is essentially, I guess, a research project or a discovery project of some sort where it's 90% new and 10% fixed? Tell me something about how you characterize those three different buckets, and then we're going to be trying to find some examples around that.
Sure. The key is whenever you move off of 100.0% defined, the second you move away from that, you're in a completely different space. Manufacturing is the absolute special case, the singularity that exists when no one is changing anything during the period of execution. Most of the PM world doesn't operate just like a high-volume production line would. So if it's 1% or 2% changes here and there, you can pretty much use the same production model. You'll pick up a slight inefficiency because of rework or kind of being surprised by things, but it won't dominate the equation. When you get up into about the 5 or 10% different, although that seems pretty trivial just to change the taillights or the trim or to put it in a new package or a color this year, you'll find that the dependencies of all of those decisions add up much more rapidly than you would think. So a 10% change can actually double the difficulty of doing a developmental project. When you get up into the 80, 90, 95% never seen before level of something like a lot of the NASA work or some of the things that I've done on advanced military and aerospace projects, it's a completely different model.
Talk to me about one that was a 90-10, 90% new, 10% fixed, really complicated project. You want to talk us through that?
The best example of a crazy out there project I can give you, Kendall, is Ice Cube. It is literally a cubic kilometer volume of ice at Amundsen Scott Station at the South Pole. It was roughly $270 million. National Science Foundation in the U.S. was the major source of funding for that. We also had funding from partners in Germany, Sweden, and Belgium. But the instrument is a high-energy physics research project. It is termed by the NSF as a discovery-class instrument. And that makes them a particular design challenge because the physicists who were giving me guidance on what they wanted the instrument to do were in fact speculating about the nature of the universe and coming up with theories about how the universe might work. So the instrument that I designed had to be flexible enough to deal with any of the uncertainty in the understanding of what they wanted the device to do. They didn't know what they wanted the baby to grow up into because they wanted to see what it wanted to be later. So when this instrument was first turned on, they realized that there were some extraordinarily high energy particles out there at or even beyond the best hopes of the researchers. And they were able to tune the behavior of the instrument to be more effective at trying to understand and draw information from that. So my job was to gather all of the range of uncertainty from all of the stakeholders about what they might want this thing to be when it was done and what they might want to use it for after they discovered something interesting, and as much as I could to preserve that flexibility into the future.
So let's talk about difficult conditions, just from the known stuff, right? It had to be hard.
Yeah, just some of the gee whiz things. If you've ever been in Dubai and you've seen the Burj Dubai Tower or Chicago, the Sears Tower, Willis Tower, imagine 3, 4, maybe 5 of those buildings stacked up on top of each other, except going straight down into ice. That's how deep the deepest sensors are on the ice. They're 2,450 meters deep in the ice. To get a hole in ice and put a sensor in it 2,400 meters down needs a lot of equipment. So now, okay, I want to put sensors in the ice. How am I going to get them there? Well, you don't exactly have a big cordless drill with a 2,500-meter bit on it hanging around at the South Pole, so we had to invent a hot water heater that was able to melt a column of liquid water 2,500 meters deep, about a meter in diameter, so that these instruments, the instrumentation could be lowered into the ice, and then when it refroze, it made a single solid structure. Mm-hmm. And when someone comes up to you and says, I want to put these little eggshell sensors with a glass photomultiplier tube in, basically vacuum tubes, 2,400 meters deep in the ice. There's 10,000 pounds of pressure of just the water sitting above it. And, oh, by the way, did we mention that this will all freeze back in? You know, they'd start rattling this stuff off. And most people would run screaming for the exits. You need a PM and an engineering team that sort of goes, well, it's not completely impossible, so I guess we'll keep working on it.
What was the outcome of all that?
A spectacularly successful instrument. The devices in ice, which were my primary focus for it, are exceeding what were already extremely high reliability expectations for the devices. But the fact that the parts that are in ice, that are inaccessible, that are the source of the quality of all of the data, are overperforming against every technical requirement they were given, and also in terms of reliability, means that the investment that the taxpayer made in that instrument will likely have a much better return than it would otherwise. So that's the piece I'm probably the most proud of. The tricky parts of it, just the time delay of getting stuff to the pole, the complications of doing work in an environment with international treaty obligations. So the PM has to take on a really tricky role in these projects to balance out the stakeholders' desire to achieve what in some cases may be an unrealistic goal and the engineers' desire to optimize to what may be an unrealistic level the performance of things that are possible. So you run up against a social problem of one group of people who loves to play with possibilities, sometimes beyond the window or the budget of the project, and another group of people who are used to things being defined very rapidly because they already exist and seeing evidence of execution. And when you put those two expectations against each other, if somebody isn't acting as an ambassador to communicate between those two camps, either the stakeholders will say, shoot the engineers and ship something, or the engineers will win and they will simply use up all of the market time and budget and you won't ship a product.
It strikes me that you'll really need good communication, and so you need pretty strong feedback, particularly if you're not the one who's an expert in the space.
The PM as a business system manager is a different role, but he or she very much is trying to make sure that the effort is successful by balancing out the stakeholders, the engineering inputs, and all of the traditional PM dimensions. And you're right, it's all about communication. So the PM doesn't have to be technical. I make no claim whatsoever to having anywhere near the physics credentials other than an engineer who survived the classes and went on and got a degree. But I could communicate with the physics expertise that was on that project, and I could understand from them what was important to them in what orders, and when they had to make trade-offs, what they considered the best shape of that trade curve. And I was able to get those groups of people together and get them to agree on what was generally a shared set of, if we take the instrument in this direction, all of us are better off, even though, yeah, I give up a little my sensitivity in order for you to get that. The project as a whole was safer when everybody agreed.
To learn more about Randy's theories and techniques, look for the book Integrating Project Management and Systems Engineering, Methods, Tools, and Organizational Systems for Improving Performance. Hot off the presses, this collaborative effort, and yes, Randy was part of the team, between MIT, NCOSI, and PMI, incorporates the latest research on the subject. It's available in digital and hard copy at Amazon, PMI, and through the publisher, Wiley.